Commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules. And at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome back to another edition of BOA The Revival. Very excited about tonight's show. We've got a really cool guest for you and an awesome, awesome topic. Our guest is Alex Matsuo, and we're going to be talking about her book, Women of the Paranormal. And even though we're only using the audio, I like to do this with the guest just to prove my guilty conscience from high school. I did read the book. You can even see the notes up in here. Women of the Paranormal, Volume 1, A Brief History. Absolutely fantastic. I use this compliment sparingly on the show, but it is an absolute tour de force. It is fantastic. It is really, really good stuff. And it's, look, I've been in this field for almost 20 years now, and I learned so much from reading this book. I was absolutely blown away and enlightened after I had finished the book. And so I absolutely loved it. I highly recommend it to all the Banal of America listeners. It is fantastic. It belongs in the library of all serious students of the paranormal. And to give you a little background on Alex, where do I have my notes here? Alex, she's a paranormal researcher, singer, and author. And she's the founder of the Association of Paranormal Study and runs the blog and YouTube channel, The Spooky Stuff. And in addition to Women of the Paranormal, Volume 1, A Brief History, she's also the author of One Bed Over, A Hospital Haunting, The Brave Mortal's Guide to Ghost Hunting, The Haunting of the 10th Avenue Theater, More Than Ghosts, A Guide to Working Residential Cases in the Paranormal, and The Haunted Actor, and possibly even more. But that was what I found online. So, and you can find out more from her at alexmatsuo.com. Alex, of course, you can spell that. MATSUO.com. So there's all the information. And Women of the Paranormal, we can get it on Amazon. So pick it up, folks. You're going to want to get it after you hear this conversation because I'm already beyond excited about talking about it. So welcome to the show, Alex. It's really a great treat to get you on here and to talk about this awesome, awesome book.
Yeah, Tim, thanks for having me on. I'm already having a blast, you know, just hearing your intro.
Well, I meant every word I said. I really love the book. And for folks who are wondering, like, well obviously, it's Women in the Paranormal. One aspect of the book that I really loved a lot is it's sort of there's 38 women, I believe, profiled in the book. And they're these sort of nice little, I don't want to say bite-sized, but sort of little chapters of each a biography, a little mini biography of each of these pioneering women and their contributions to the field and their background and their life story in a way, and their legacy. And it's like, it's just a great, fun book for reading. If I was a teacher, and I think I might have been in a different life. My mother was a teacher, a lifelong teacher. But this is the kind of book, if I was a teacher, this is the kind of thing that I would have in my classroom and be like, here, you take this chapter, you take that chapter, like, and each of you come back with a paper on it or whatever. It's just tremendous, tremendous stuff. I really enjoyed it. So, you know, we start out each sort of new time a guest is on the show with the bio, the background. You know, who is Alex Matsuo? How did you get mixed up in all this stuff?
Yes, the origin story. So, yeah, I had experiences when I was a kid. So after my grandfather died, I want to say about a year or two after that event happened, I had my first experience. And then I would have like little pockets of experience. I like to call them pockets of experiences because then I would have like almost like a month of like experiences and then it would just kind of stop and then it would come back again. Sometimes it would happen in a theater. Sometimes it was a creepy, oogie creature, like in my bedroom or, but it wasn't enough to, like, I guess, actively pursue, but I was also a kid at the time. The big catalyst was after I was in a really bad car accident on New Year's Eve of 2005. I had to go to the hospital. It was a really, really bad accident. I ended up with a vertically sheared pelvis, 3 broken vertebrae, a shattered tailbone.
Oh,
like, it was a bad accident. When I was in the trauma room, I had what I could only explain as maybe an out-of-body experience. I don't think it was a near-death experience because I didn't have like the classic near-death experience signs.
Right.
Like, I didn't see a light. I could get up and walk around. I could see my mom and my friends in the hospital lobby. But there was another person in the room, in the trauma room with me, because New Year's Eve 2005, there was a lot of accidents happening that night. Plus, it was raining in San Diego, California, and San Diegans, we can't drive. We freak out, you know, when it rains. So the hospitals were packed full. In fact, the ambulance couldn't even take me to the nearest hospital because it was already full. So we were sharing trauma rooms. And when I was having my out-of-body experience, the other guy in the room was also having could have been an out-of-body experience. I survived that night. He did not. And he ended up attaching himself to me.
Oh, God.
And it lasted for about 8 months.
Wow.
And during that time, and at this point, it was 2006. The paranormal community back then did not really exist. Not what we have now. Like today, if I was dealing with a spirit attachment, I could probably put a post on Facebook and 10, 20 teams would reach out to me saying, hey, yeah, we'll help. Back in 2006, not so much. Especially when you're in a very conservative Christian household with an equally conservative Christian social circle. So, you know, it's like one of those things, like, you didn't talk about it really because you didn't want to be judged. You know, you talked to your pastor about getting help and the pastor's like, I'm not touching that. We ended up getting help from the Greek Orthodox Church because they were like, oh yeah, we'll come check it out. We'll come help. More so put a muzzle on it than actually solving it. But at the end, it's the most anticlimactic ending, mainly because what resolved it was just showing empathy to this guy and saying things like, because the big thing he would say to me when he appeared would be, why you, not me? Why you,
oh,
not
God.
Me?
Oh, God. That would be even more haunting.
A little bit, right? He was really having a hard time processing his death. And eventually what ultimately ended all of it was me just empathizing with him saying, like, I'm sorry this happened to you. I'm sorry this is the situation, but we can't fix it. We can't do anything about it. It is what it is. We can either keep doing this and drive each other crazy, or you can move on and I can move on. And that's what ultimately solved it. I mean, I ended up seeing him a couple more times after that, but it was not nearly as bad as it was when he was constantly around. But experiencing that and experiencing the lack of support and the lack of help was what inspired me to get more into this. And about 5 years later, after I was done with grad school, I started the Association of Paranormal Study. Specializing in residential cases, businesses, and just being a resource to the community. We've evolved and changed a little bit over the last almost 13 years now. Like, we don't really do a lot of residential cases anymore, mainly because, like, the climate has changed in the paranormal, like, and people who have experienced hauntings. I mean, social media has been a big factor with those changes. It started to get hard to differentiate between, like, okay, you want to go on TikTok Live while we do this and why?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
It changed quite a bit. And we'll take cases on a case-by-case basis. But what we do now is we have a very heavy vetting system. So we'll usually have them fill out a case form. And then we do like a consult on Zoom or Google Meet and just say, like, hey, you know, tell us a little bit more about what's going on. Usually the consult is enough for them to decide to either not work with us or try the resolutions that we suggested, and it's fine. So it's changed a bit. So we've pivoted more to be more research heavy. I don't want to say academic, but, you know, writing articles. And we're hosting our very first paranormal conference this summer in Gettysburg. And Saturday, August 17th, we're doing the Paranormal Research Symposium. And I'm also trying to figure out, like, how can APS exist nationwide, where – because I travel a lot for my job.
Right.
So it's like, how can this team keep going if I'm in London for a week, or if I have to move to Seattle, like how can this group keep going?
Right.
So I had to like think like bigger picture of the team, but that car accident, the attachment that happened after, that was a big factor in who I am today.
I can imagine. So when this spirit was attached to you, so he was kind of, I hate to like it. Was it like ghost? Was it like with how the guy kept coming, how Patrick Swayze kept coming and kind of bothering to be more and stuff? I mean, Whoopi Goldberg kind of?
That's kind of what I'm imagining. Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of how he was. I mean, he didn't really have like a glow about him. It was just more like he was as real as, you know, you sitting here right now. The way he presented himself changed depending on like his mood. So if he was being really aggressive that day, he was more like, I'm pretty sure he was a biker because he was wearing all leather. And I did see him next to me when I was still conscious, and his outfit was torn to ribbons. Think there was like some asphalt skidding that happened
right.
as well.
Yeah.
So he would appear more bloody and injured. Other times he would be like just very clean. He would be clean,
yeah.
like hair combed, clean. And that was when he was like more so neutral. He wasn't really ever in a good mood, or never really saw anything positive with him, but he had his neutral, then he had his like pissed off phase.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
I can't even imagine. Yeah. That's yeah.
And after that, have I been able to see any sort of ghosts or spirits like that since? Nah.
Nah,
I was the chosen one for him, apparently, but I've also been told by several mediums that experience traumatized me so much that I built a wall to ever seeing.
Interesting.
That's
yeah.
fair.
Yeah, and I could also see, like, we don't understand how this all works, so I could almost see, like, if you guys both sort of burst out into the ether at the same time, like, I could see how somehow there would be some kind of, like, he gets stuck onto you almost, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think that's
the other thing. Yeah, and the only other time I have been able to see something was, I always joke that there has to be like a full moon, the planets have to be perfectly aligned, and a moonbeam has to hit the third leaf off of the fifth tree in the Appalachian Mountains. Like, I make that kind of joke of like for me to ever really see anything. I went ghost hunting after I found out that a very dear family member passed away. But there was really nothing I could do about it at that moment. And plus, I had already paid for the investigation. So I was like, yeah, I'll just go ahead and go. I should not have gone because I was an emotional mess the entire time. But I did see a gentleman in this building we were investigating. And I could see him clear as day, just like the man in the leather jacket and the biker outfit.
Right.
And I was like, this is something I have not experienced since 2006. Okay. okay. But that was me being in a very vulnerable state, grieving. I was exhausted. Like, I had been up all night, the night before, and I didn't sleep during the day. And then I was out investigating in Gettysburg, of all places. Yeah. So that's the only other time but that's it.
Yeah, that's a fascinating origin story. That's really, a lot of guests are like, I watched Unsolved Mysteries as a kid, and here I am. So it's like, okay, me too.
Me too. Well, here's the thing. I loved Unsolved Mysteries. I loved Are You Afraid of the Dark? Now, this was before the car accident. My mom was very anti-paranormal. Like, I basically watched Are You Afraid of the Dark in my grandmother's bedroom because we lived with my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I basically went to her room to watch Unsolved Mysteries, Are You Afraid of the Dark, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. That book, I had to leave it at school because I could, or I,
oh,
it would
wow.
have to be like in my, if I put it in my backpack, it had to be like in my math book or something.
Right.
Like
right.
I was hiding porn.
Yeah.
My mom was very anti, like, divination, ghosts, anything new age, because again, conservative Christian. And then ironically, when she died and I was going through her stuff, I found all of these pendulums, dowsing rods, tarot cards,
oh, wow.
books on how to read tarot cards. And I'm like, this woman?
Wow.
This woman? Really?
Yeah, yeah. So you know, you start writing, you've written all these books. This is, I believe this is like your most recent one now. This is, how did, I mean, I can kind of understand the inspiration for this book, but what made you decide to write this book? You kind of explain in the book, but you know, it's a podcast, so.
Yeah. Oh no, that's it. It's fine. Yeah. So couple things. So I ran into Catherine Crowe's name several years ago, actually right after I founded my team. I had done a presentation on poltergeist, on like the origin of poltergeist, and I ran into Catherine Crowe's name. I didn't really think anything of it, though, because at the time I didn't realize how marginalized women were in the paranormal field, in the parapsychology field. I didn't think anything of it. And then it wasn't until, I want to say, several years ago where – There was a diverse period in paranormal TV for a little bit with Paranormal State. That was like probably the most diverse show.
Yeah.
Which, again, when you see that presence there, you're like, oh, yeah, it's all good. But then, like, I don't know, something in the climate changed with paranormal entertainment, and it became very heavy towards men, especially like white men. And anytime there was a woman in a show, she's either like the psychic, the historian, the witch. She wasn't necessarily at the forefront. And I started having conversations with colleagues in the community about it. And Catherine Crowe popped up again from my friend Amanda Woomer. And I'm like, oh, I know that name. And realizing like, oh, wait, Catherine Crowe was one of the first women or one of the first people to do an investigation like we do today. That's wild. And Amanda sometimes posts this meme that's like, hey, just a reminder, the first ghost hunter was Catherine Crowe. And the backlash that she gets is incredible. She actually got banned from a haunted location for posting that. And I posted it too, and I got a lot of backlash, and I got like, well, what about the priests that would exorcise ghosts or exorcise demons with whips? And I'm like, okay, but that's not a paranormal investigation. That's an exorcism.
Right, yeah.
You know, there's a difference. And so I just found there's a lot of these people just trying to discount this, the contributions by this woman.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of like my first inkling of, okay, if a lot of people don't know who Catherine Crowe is, you know, but who, it made me think like, who else is out there that we don't know about?
Right, right.
And I started off with 12 women. It was actually going to be a blog series. And then I just kept finding names and more names and finding like, holy cow, this woman was alive at the same time as Charles Dickens or alive at the same time as Aleister Crowley, but we never heard of her.
Yeah.
Or, oh my gosh, this woman ran the parapsychology unit at UCLA and assisted with the Doris Bither case that created the Entity movie, but we don't know who Thelma Moss is? Wait, what? So it was one of those like, holy cow. And I ended up with a list of about 100 women.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, okay, there's no way I can put 100 women in this book, at least not for this volume, because I was still trying to figure out exactly what is it going to be, because I wanted it to be a little bit more than a who's who list, but I didn't want it to be like a an extensive biography of every woman.
Yeah.
I did have a hard time choosing though, which is why there's 38 women in the book and not like a clean number like 30 or 35.
Yeah.
You know. So I think volume two may even it out a little bit with I'm thinking 42 just to kind of poke fun of myself too, like 42.
Yeah.
So then that way it will be 80. And then in my research I have, I think my list for volume three is at 50 right now. So yeah, it's I keep finding, so I'm thinking it's probably gonna reach at least four volumes.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it's going to be about four volumes total, I think. And of course, every time I find one woman, it kind of branches off into more.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I should look her up and see. And then I'm like, okay, she's going on the list, you know.
Well, yeah, you've mentioned Catherine Crowe a few times here now. So give people sort of a little thumbnail for the people who are listening. Because a lot of this is paranormal sort of ghostly stuff and parapsychology and sort of, for lack of a better term, sort of like psychic ability type stuff. There's a little outside of my wheelhouse. So that's how I learned a lot of stuff in the book. I'm primarily like UFOs and Bigfoot and kind of crypto stuff. So, and sort of my weakest area would be the ghost stuff and paranormal. So, so personally, I was like fascinated because I had really never dug into in general the history of sort of trying to decipher the ghost thing, because I kind of noticed a through line in the book in general that was like, okay, first we're just going to collect these ghost stories. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of like the very beginning. And it was like, all right, these things are happening. Let's just document these things that are happening that, you know, yep. have been in fiction before, but these are real stories from real people. And then it was like, all right, let's try and figure out what's happening here. And then it became like, let's try and communicate with them. And now we're, you know, it kind of evolves. I got a better understanding of the evolution of this field of study, if you will, through your book. So I really appreciated it in that way, 'cause I never really given it much thought. I was like, all right, how did that? So, but let's talk about Catherine Crowe. As you said, she did the first paranormal investigation, if you will, ghost hunter, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, so she was the one who at least documented. She's the first documented person to have done a paranormal investigation as we would know one today.
Right.
So she had already done – well, she was first and foremost, she was an author. She was also a researcher. You know, she had married young. She was in an abusive marriage, left her husband, took her kid with her, made it to Edinburgh, Scotland. She made a living independently as a writer, and actually her books had a female protagonist in it. She wrote plays also with female protagonists, so she was already like pretty forward thinking for the early 19th century.
Yeah.
So she did some translation work for a biography of Frederica Hoff. Who was known as a German – it was the Seerist of Provost. She translated that book by a German physician by the name of Justinus Kerner. So Frederica Hoff would go into convulsions and trances, and these were so bad that she was bedridden. And it seemed that that was kind of the big inspiration for her. And then she went on to, so this was also a German story. Mm-hmm. And so Catherine started to do more research into the supernatural, the unknown. And that's where her book, the groundbreaking book that is the reason why we're here today, is The Night Side of Nature.
Right.
And in that book, she introduces doppelganger, the word doppelganger, and poltergeist into English usage.
Mm-hmm.
So she's the reason why we have these words.
Right.
And what's important to note, too, is that the book came out in 1848, which was the same year that the spiritualism movement started. However, spiritualism didn't hit the United Kingdom until about 1849. So Night Side of Nature was written without any sort of spiritualism influence. But it did help spark the spiritualism movement in England. So in this book, in The Night Side of Nature, she gathered stories from people. So they were either sharing it directly with her. She asked people to write her with their own ghost stories. She looked into newspapers and as well as legends. And she was describing phenomenon that we would now call like out-of-body experiences, crisis apparitions, ESP apparitions, wraiths, time slips, near-death experiences. And this book was a huge hit. I mean, I want to say, like, I think it went through 16 different print editions. Like,
wow.
It was a huge hit. And I think the timing also worked out in her favor, too, because, you know, spiritualism was also becoming, like, the hot thing. So after she put out Night Side of Nature, obviously more and more people were writing her. You know, it's I've had this experience, too. And she got a tip from a man who his name was – she referred to him as McN. So McN's family owned a home in Edinburgh, and they couldn't keep tenants there. Tenants keep kept leaving. McEnn's family even priced the house so low, like nobody could like resist it, but people still wouldn't stay. Yeah. Tenants kept leaving. And it turned out that the house was reported to be haunted. So about 6 or 7 years later, she was talking about this haunted house to several gentlemen, and then they decided that they wanted to visit in the house. So she wanted to visit, they wanted to visit the house. So she got in touch with McEnn, who had the keys. House was vacant. Catherine got her friend to come, and her friend was a clairvoyant. Now, what was interesting, something interesting that Catherine did, she did not tell her friend, the clairvoyant, that the place was haunted. Instead, right. She told her friend, like, hey, I'm interested in buying this house and I want to know what you think about it. So how often do paranormal investigators today, it's like, you know, you don't really tell the mediums
exactly
what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, you let them like pick it up on their own. So they arrived around 11 p.m. So there was two men, a woman, the clairvoyant, and then, of course, Catherine. And they met McEnn across the street from the house. They talked to a police officer so that the cops knew that they had permission to be at the house. Something else that we do as paranormal investigators. and then, yeah, so when it came to the clairvoyant, Catherine didn't tell her. Catherine didn't tell her why they were there. And it was just really interesting how that whole process worked. So basically,
yeah,
the clairvoyant did a reading through hypnosis. They started to hear some weird sounds, and then the medium started to see white lights, but no one else could see them. And then the clairvoyant suggested to Catherine that, you know, take her hand. So when the clairvoyant grabbed Catherine's hand, Catherine could actually see the white lights as well. So it was almost like a skill transference almost.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. But Catherine didn't say anything because she was wondering if anyone else saw the light. But anyway, Catherine did say, like, hey, the group didn't get great results, but McEnn came back. She asked the rest of the group, hey, did you all see the light? The group said no. But then McEnn said, was it like a bright spark of light, like an oxyhydrogen light? And Catherine's like, yes. And then McEnn's like, oh, yeah, that's something that happens a lot around here. So, but that was very much like a modern paranormal investigation,
right,
as we would
yeah.
see it today. And there's nothing else like that documented. And the foundation that Catherine set in that particular book, the book that has the paranormal investigation, I think it's called Ghosts and Family Legends off the top of my head, Stories for Christmas. And but that story and her research methodology and the process that she did actually helped set the foundation for the Society of Psychical Research.
Yeah.
So, which... that's, you know, no small feat right there.
Yeah, exactly. It's tremendous. And it's remarkable. She's actually probably one of the more well-known, I guess you could say, in the book, just because she's kind of like, there's been sort of a modern-day appreciation for her contribution. It really is remarkable for people to, like, they hear this story. You remember, folks, this is like 1850 or whatever, or like sometime in the 1800s. It's completely... it's a whole different world. So to be, but she's doing a pretty much modern day version of a paranormal investigation.
Yep.
It's pretty remarkable. I'm going to skip ahead. We're going to go unchronological from the book. Cause that leads me to kind of want to bring up another player in the book. Great. Now there you go. All right. And that's probably my favorite chapter of the book is Rosina Despard. Because the reason why I sort of pointed out to folks, you got to remember this is like the 1850s. Now that Rosina was operating in a different time, but you may be able to tell me the years, but certainly before all this modern technology, but easily. And you point out in the book, she's staying at a house. I'm going to give a sort of brief thought. Staying at the house, they think there's a ghost. They're under the impression that there's some kind of spirit there, a woman in black. moving around. And at one point, she goes out to the hall to catch a glimpse of this spirit, and the candle goes out. And so then she's like, well, I'm pretty much shit out of luck here. Like, I got to go back in the room because it's now pitch black. And that's like, it kind of reading the, I'm reading the book and I'm like, oh, like it didn't kind of really dawn on me. It's like all this stuff is happening like by candlelight. This is how far back this is going on. So it's a really, it really is remarkable when you think about it, just to put yourself in that kind of position. Like, imagine doing a ghost hunt under candlelight. It's like, wow, that would be pretty, you gotta be pretty brave to be pulling off something like that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, gosh, it's a whole different ball game when you're in a house that's pretty much pitch black. I mean, this is pre-electricity, right? So candlelight, that's it. Then the candle goes out, like you see an apparition, a woman in black, and you go out to go chase her down, and then the candle goes out. It's like,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
My worst nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's a little
yeah.
Terrifying. But yeah, the story of what's so cool about Rosina too is she ended up writing one of the most authoritative accounts of a haunting as a teenager. As a teenager of all ages. It wasn't like this, like an old man, like scientist, you know, documenting things. It was a teenager, and she was also very smart, like kind of wise beyond her years too, because she was also, she was 19 when all of this started, and, you know, she was documenting all of this through letters to her friend Catherine Campbell, who may or may not have been a partner or a lover. Catherine was not eager to surrender a lot of the letters to SPR, and it's alleged that maybe some of those letters were a little spicy.
Yeah, I remember that.
You
part
know,
book,
I
yeah.
mean, it's gosh, there's a whole, I mean, I could write a whole other book about SPR being a safe haven for the queer community. Maybe that'll be my next book. That's the whole thing. So Rosina was also trying to get into medical school at this time too. So not only is she dealing with this haunting and documenting it, she is studying. She is getting into medical school. After the whole event, she actually went on to become a doctor, and then she became an assistant medical officer at a sanatorium, which was actually a woman's prison. But yeah, it was just very interesting. And her family stayed at that house for quite some time after she left, and she was still able to document a few things. So
what I thought was interesting about her story is also that it seemed like she spent a lot of time trying to, well, she researched like the house and tried to figure out who the ghost could have been. And I thought it was interesting where it seemed like she kind of got, she probably sort of pinned down the identity of the ghost. And then the hauntings kind of seemed to dissipate. And it was like, I wonder if there's some connection there. Like, I wonder if like, if you can, like once, if you figure out the ghost, if it kind of like gives them some kind of relief to sort of like dissipate or move on to whatever, or just they have no longer have an effect on you, on the person, where it's like, or I know you're Susan, or I know you're Bruce or whatever, and it's like, come on, I'm not scared of you. You know, you have no effect on me anymore because I know your identity and everything. I don't know. It just kind of made me think, like, I wonder if there's something to that aspect of it.
Yeah. It's almost like the unknown thrives to, and wants to stay unknown.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, oh crap, she's finding more information about us. It's time to fall back.
Fall back. Exactly.
Let's calm down.
Right. It made me wonder. The other part, a little detail in that, just something about that story really provided a really interesting glimpse of that time period, because the house kept changing names. That's what I loved, too, about the house that she was in. The house passed hands, and then they would change the name of the house. Then it was like, then it became Cottonwood Manor. And then it's like, then this guy bought it. And then it became, you know, Silver Spring, you know, I don't know, Silver Spring. So it's just like, they just keep changing the name of the house. It's like, we don't name houses enough anymore. That's
You know,
my takeaway.
Yeah, that was kind of my thing too. I'm like, why don't we name houses anymore? I mean, actually, where I live, there are a couple of there's several houses that have names, but I think it's just because people are too rich up here. Well,
Right,
not really
yeah.
rich, but I live in one of the most expensive areas of the country. So when you get into the really bougie neighborhoods, it's
Yes,
you
yeah.
start to run into property names, and a lot of them are like farms and stuff or wineries too. So it's like, ah, okay. I live in the DC metro area,
Gotcha,
so
yeah, Virginia area.
yeah.
Yeah, that was, like I said, that was one of my favorite stories because it really sort of felt very like a glimpse into her time period. And so I'm moving to a different one now. What I was really surprised by, and I think you point out in the book, this kind of didn't come to light until recently, was Helen Peters Nosworthy, who actually named the Ouija board. And it's like,
Yes.
I mean, I think you credited Robert Murch for uncovering this. We had Robert on, I think, probably before he found out about this, because we had him on a long time ago, talking about the history of the Ouija board. And I don't recall that ever coming up. You mentioned he kind of found this out sort of, no more than maybe 10 years ago or something. So talk about someone who was lost to history literally until just very recently, and who had an enormous impact on popular culture. It's unbelievable.
Huge, huge impact. Yeah, Helen was somebody that I hadn't found out about until I went to go to the I went I visited the Witchboard Museum in Salem, who is run by John Kosiak, I think is his last name, who's part of the Talking Board Historical Society. I already knew merch. We had talked quite a bit. I had him on my podcast to talk Ouija boards, and I actually started collecting Ouija boards. So obviously I wasn't talk to him, especially if I found something. I would just text it, take a picture and text it, and he would tell me like, oh yeah, I can tell with where this time period this is from. So I was at the Witchboard Museum, and John Kosiak had a sketch of Helen Peters Nosworthy on the wall, and he was talking about her, and I'm like, hold up, wait, she did what now? She did what? So when he told me that she was part of naming the Ouija board, I immediately like wrote her name on my hand, and I was like, okay, I got to follow up with this. But one of my favorite stories with this, with the naming of the board, is so Helen got married fairly late in life, especially for the time period. She got married, I believe it was in her 30s, and she actually married a guy who was a little younger than her, and I'm like, good for you. Yeah, so she, oh yeah, she was 39 and he was 27. So I was like, good for you.
Nice,
Good for you, Helen. good for you. And ironically, he was the son of a spiritualist in Britain. So I thought that was interesting. But the naming of the Ouija board. So Helen was an avid follower of a British feminist named Marie Louise Ramé, I think, if I'm remembering that name correctly. You have to check the book to fact check me. But she was also known under a pen name of Ouida, Ouida. And so women who supported Ouida would often wear a pendant with the name Ouida and her picture. And it's believed that Helen wore a Ouida pendant. So the story around that is the night the Ouija board was named, she was using the board as well as Charles Kennard, and she asked, what do you want the board to be named? And then spelled Ouija. And after that, Helen went up to Kennard and been like, listen, I have this pendant on my around my neck with this. Are we sure about this? But Kennard was like, oh, this is amazing. And yeah, so call it Ouija. So there's a possibility that the Ouija board name is an unintentional nod to one of the most prominent British feminists of the 19th century, which I love. I
Yeah,
love
it's pretty
that.
awesome. Yeah.
But Helen did believe in the power of the board too. She was a fairly strong medium, as she was described by her brother-in-law Elijah Bond. And ironically, given the area where I live, I'm like, oh, Baltimore is just like less than an hour away. I can actually go to all these places. And they actually came to D.C. to the patent office to prove, they had to prove the power of the board before they could get their patent. But I know later she was not a big fan of the board because she believed that the board lied about some family drama regarding some family heirlooms of the South.
Yeah.
So she wasn't like thrilled about the board at the end of her life. I mean, she got married. They moved to Colorado. They adopted a daughter. Ernest, her husband, became a traveling salesman, and she kind of disappeared off the map. A lot of the newspaper articles that even mention her, Ernest Nosworthy, were Ernest Nosworthy checked in at the blah, blah, blah hotel, and he departed on this day, because that's what the news reported on back then. But yeah, so she passed in Colorado. That's where she's buried. And Murch is in Colorado, I believe. And
yeah,
so he actually had a lot of contacts with her family.
Oh, wow.
And he actually helped mend some family drama. So they were indebted to him about that. And actually, he and the Talking Board Historical Society raised money to basically get Helen a new headstone with a Ouija board on it, to just, or the Ouija logo,
yeah,
you know, to honor her legacy and her contribution to the Ouija board. But yeah, that was a story I didn't really know until about a year and a half ago. She was one of the last additions to the book. I was like, yeah, she has to go into volume one. Like,
yeah. It was really amazing. It was like I said. I mean, you point out earlier, Catherine Crowe. She's introducing doppelganger and poltergeist into the vernacular here in America, and you got Helen Peters Nosworthy with the Ouija board, and I guess we'll continue the theme here. I'll scooch up in my notes here, because another woman in the book who it made an indelible imprint on pop culture, the paranormal, the zeitgeist, is Pamela Coleman Smith.
I was absolutely
blown away, and you mentioned in the just a spoiler alert, folks, she drew. What are erroneously, I guess you could say, in a lot of ways, known as the Rider-Waite Tarot Deck. And so, like, when you mention in the book, you call him the Rider-Waite Smith Tarot Deck, and I'm like, is this like a Berenstain Bears situation? I'm like, wait a minute, have I always been getting this wrong? And then I read the chapter, and I'm like, I have been getting it wrong, but because I've been informed incorrectly by history of how this thing came about. And it's like, wait a minute, now this lady, her name should be on the deck. I don't even know who Rider and Waite are, but I think Waite was the one who, you know, kind of instructed on how to do it,
or
the ideas or whatever. So it should be the Waite Smith deck. I don't know who Rider is. Maybe that was the one who published it.
That was the publisher. Yeah.
But yeah, not the publisher. Maybe he shouldn't get any credit at all. It should be the Waite Smith deck, but it's remarkable. I was like I said, I'm like, wait a minute, what? Like, what? Like, this is crazy. So I've given the banal version of events. So tell us, sort of flesh this out and give us the story here of how she wound up drawing this deck. And it's really remarkable that she's been lost to history in so many ways.
Yeah, she's not only been lost to history, but there's a lot of speculation, too, about her ethnicity. Every year during Black History Month, she gets included, but it's that one I don't touch on TikTok, especially. But there was someone else who had met her who thought she was part Japanese, you know, because her features are very striking, her facial features. But yeah, so I feel like her and I would have been besties, because she's kind of like exactly like the type of person I hang out with. So her father was a merchant, her mother, her parents were actually also older too. Well, her dad was in his 20s and her mom was in her 30s, but when they got married, her mother was the sister of an American painter by the name of Samuel Coleman. It's speculated that Corinne may have been of Jamaican descent, but as far as we know, Pamela's parents were American, and they were based in England, though, for the first like 10 years of Pamela's life. Mm-hmm. She had her struggles. She had a hard time with gender, class, racial categories, as I mentioned. Her family were members of the Swedenborgian New Church, so they very much followed the practices of Emanuel Swedenborg, who was one of the earliest psychics, you could say, trance mediums. So Pamela already was exposed to like spiritism and mysticism in her young life. And then her father took a job in Jamaica. He was working as an auditor for the West India Improvement Company. And so they lived in Jamaica for several years. And then when Pamela was 15, she went to go study art at the Pratt Institute in New York.
Yes.
And she learned about various art styles. She learned about Art Nouveau. Her mother got sick while she was in school, and then so Pamela dropped out of school and went back to Jamaica. She actually never got her art degree, and she basically became her mother's caregiver until she passed. And then Pamela kind of became the head of the household, not headed like head of the household like paying for things, but she ran the household.
Right.
So she wasn't really able to be an artist, but then. She also had a fascination with Jamaican folklore, and she even contributed to the Journal of American Folklore when she was 18, so which is pretty amazing. And she actually did performances reenacting Jamaican folklore stories. But she wasn't too far away from art. In 1897, she got her first exhibition at William Macbeth's gallery. Yeah, so she was 19 when this all happened for her. So she actually started to have a career as an illustrator, and she created her own illustration books. And then her father actually ended up introducing her to Bram Stoker.
Yes, I remember this part of the. Yes, I remember.
Yeah.
It's such a weird character to pop up. It's like, wait a minute, the Brahmin?
Yeah, and she actually called him Uncle Brahmi. So they were close. And Ellen Terry, that was another one who she was introduced to. And they actually commissioned Pamela to create an 18-page illustrated brochure for the Lyceum Theater. Pamela actually went on tour with Ellen Terry, Bram Stoker, and Henry Irving.
Yes, I'm remembering this story. Yeah.
Yeah, she actually became really good friends with them. They actually gave her a nickname. She became known as Pixie. She was also a costumer, a stage designer. Ellen Terry really took Pamela under her wing. And then when Pamela wasn't touring with the theater group, she actually was a kindergarten teacher, which I thought was hilarious. But then Pamela's father passed away. So she was just 21 years old, and she was without both parents. Henry Irving and Ellen Terry actually ended up taking on like a pseudo parent role for her. And they actually helped her find work. So she illustrated Bram Stoker's last novel. Did work for William Yeats. She did work for Jack Yeats. She opened her own studio in 1901. So, I mean, she was really making a name for herself in art. So it's really not surprising that she would get – and she was also getting involved in occultism too.
Right.
So she became a member of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and that's where she met Waite, A.E. Waite. They were both members of the Isis Urania Lodge of the Golden Dawn. And then Pamela started to have an interest in astrology, which would become the foundation for her tarot deck drawings. So Waite was a big fan of Pamela. He loved her work. And then he found these occult manuscripts that related to tarot. And he wanted to make the deck more meaningful. So that's where he brought in Pamela to do the illustrations. And it's believed that Waite didn't expect Pamela to go into, like, such complexities and depth in her designs.
Yeah.
Just because, like, when you meet her, apparently she was just so playful and naive, and but yet she really created some depth with these cards.
Yeah.
What blows my mind, though, was that she was not paid a lot of money. At all.
Right,
she
yeah,
did
you
not,
mentioned that in the book,
yeah. Because yeah, actually towards the end of her life, she did convert to Catholicism, which I thought was a very, like, 180 switch.
Yeah.
But she was actually writing to people, you know, to former clients. She also wrote back to William Macbeth asking, like, hey, can you give me any work? I didn't make a lot of money from the tarot deck. I really need money. And she actually took on a more somber religious perspective into life. So she had quite a journey too. Like, she was very much like bohemian type of person. You know, it's speculated that she was also queer. You know, she hosted like art painting sessions in her home, poetry readings. Like,
right,
she was
right.
very much artist as bohemian artist, like at the biggest extreme, but then she pivots and converts to Catholicism. And her God, I will never forget this. Her occupation when she died was listed as a spinster of independent means. Which I was like, wow. Okay.
Odd. Yeah.
Yeah, I found it was very interesting. So she did pass away at home when she was 73. So
yeah,
yeah,
it's just remarkable.
She,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, interrupt you there. The big part, yeah, it sort of captures in a sense the theme of the marginalization of women in the paranormal. It's like her name should be on the deck. It's really
yeah.
remarkable. It's really kind of stunning to me when I discovered this in the book. I was like, I just always assumed I was always assumed either Ryder or Waite, whoever these people are. I always
yep.
assumed one of them drew them. I didn't know. It was really like, oh, wait, you're telling me, no pun intended, wait, you're, you know, this is someone else drew the
yep.
thing? It was like,
yep.
that's really wild.
It really
it's
is.
Crazy.
And I have a book, like, I basically bought, like, two biographies on her because the books were beautiful because they also include all of her art. And if you look at all of her art outside of the tarot deck, you can definitely see like, oh,
see
yeah,
tarot, yeah.
Yeah, you can see the tarot. You can see tarot in there,
yeah.
which is really neat. So she was
right,
very
right.
talented, very
now,
talented.
Did this thing like take off right away after they came out with it? Or was it sort of like a cult, no pun intended, like a cult following sort of like underground thing that it only became bigger later?
From my understanding, it took off pretty quickly,
okay. yeah.
which is
probably.
Why, like, her not making a lot of money from it, which probably means she took a flat rate
right,
as a commission
right. yeah.
And didn't do royalties, which is a shame.
Right.
Yeah, and that's why even back then it was so shocking that she didn't make a lot of money from the deck because it was a huge hit. I mean, because the Ouija board was also in existence, I think, by this point. And Ouija
yeah.
board sales were also high,
right,
especially
right.
after wars, you know, around the time of war. Ouija board sales, tarot card sales were skyrocketing because, you know, lack of closure and all that good
yeah.
stuff that happened in the 18th, 19th, 20th century.
Now I'm gonna put you on the spot here. Maybe this was on me. I wasn't sure. No, I saw you. I saw that. So Anna Goodrich Freer. Yes. Now in the beginning of the chapter, you say that she may or may not have played a role in the death of one of SBR's most prominent members, but that's never mentioned in the chapter unless I missed it. I read it like two or three times, and I'm like, where is the part with the mysterious death? Is it
yeah.
Okay, can you enlighten me to that?
That is a little bit of my bad, but
okay.
I didn't follow up on it. Yeah, well, a lot of it's because a lot of it, gosh, the death surrounding this particular SBR member is, God, where do I even begin
with that? Murky at best?
It's murky at best, yeah. It's very much murky at best because she was one of the last she was one of the last people to, oh my gosh, why is his name, why is his name escaping me? Oh my gosh, it's like I got Myers. I'm trying to think. Oh my gosh. But yeah, so with yeah, because I briefly mention him in the Eleanor Sidgwick. Maybe. Nope. Okay.
I'm not sure. Yeah. I apologize. I didn't mean to.
Oh, you're fine. You're fine.
I have like OCD. That part was like, I literally went back and read the chapter like four times. I'm like, where did I?
Yeah. It was Edmund Gurney. Yeah. I think what happened was I mentioned it. Then I looked into the bias that Trevor Hall has against SPR. And mm-hmm. I was like, maybe not follow up on that. But
yeah.
So Edmund Gurney, overall, it's believed that Edmund Gurney committed suicide.
Yeah.
But there is some questions. So Ada Goodrich Freer was one of the last people to see Edmund Gurney alive.
Okay.
And, yeah, it's a little messy, but it's a spicy one. Edmund Gurney, God, I feel he's somebody I feel bad about. So it's more believed that maybe he accidentally overdosed on chloroform.
Oh, Jesus.
I believe that's what it was. It was an overdose of chloroform. It could have been suicide, then Trevor Hall was like, oh, I think Ada Goodrich Freer may have been involved with it because, you know, it was because she was with Arthur Thomas Myers at the time. And Trevor Hall really wanted to paint Ada in the worst light possible. He probably, probably got that from the chapter. So, and I felt like he was reaching for straws with a lot of it. But unfortunately, his book is probably the only biography of Ada that exists. I actually want to do a little more research into her to kind of give her a second chance, so to speak. Right. Because she kind of gets painted as this seductress harlot type of thing, like sleeping her way to the top of SPR.
Yeah,
being in charge of Clandon House investigations. And
right, you mentioned that. Well, you don't mention it that way in the book, but you mentioned that the perception that had been put forward, and you it was actually, I mean, you can't miss it in the book. You underline it in the mm-hmm. book where someone had, and you'll know who wrote the letter, I assume, but it was a letter taking issue with her research at this mm-hmm. place, you know, suggesting that it wasn't on the level or whatever. And it said simply because she's a lady, she was chosen to investigate. And you stress that in the book, that was, I don't know what you'd even call it, the accusation or whatever. I don't know, the marginalization or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just kind of like, what does that have to do with it, dude? But clearly there was an implication there of something nefarious.
Yeah, exactly. So that's definitely one of those things that, like, as I was reading Trevor Hall's biography of her, I really started to realize, I'm like, okay, we're going out of scope here with – Because if she was doing faulty research, that's fine. Let's stick to the faulty research.
Right.
So it kind of goes from, like, she's having an affair with Myers, Frederick Myers, to she was a dom with a woman as her sub. And it's like, okay.
Well, this is all in this guy's biography?
Yeah, all in this guy's biography. Geez. Oh, yeah. He definitely has a an obsession with Ada. Like, a part of me was like, okay, what did this woman do to hurt you? Like, show me on the doll where she touched you.
When did this guy write this book? Like, around her time?
60s? No, it would have been 60s or 70s. So. Yeah, it's Trevor Hall. Let me take a look here. When was he alive? He also had a big issue with SPR, so he wrote a lot of why am I looking on the computer? I can look on my phone. He wrote a lot of very disparaging content about SPR.
Yeah. SPR. And he sort of sounds like he sort of had a bee in his bonnet for Ada Goodrich Freer.
Trevor H. Hall. There he is. Yeah, he died in 1991. So 1910 to 1991. So, yeah, he was definitely not alive when – well, when did Ada die. Let me take a look at my notes. Ada passed away in 1931. So he would have been actually there would have been, he would have been in his 30s when she died. So
yeah,
you know, there may be some minor crossover, but whether or not he actually talked to her is debatable.
Interesting. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's just kind of, it's just kind of lame that the guy's dragging her through the mud. Like, I don't know, dude. It's just kind of like,
he did
intrusive.
That with several, yeah, he did that to several, people in SPR too, unfortunately.
Yeah.
That's kind of his MO.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's disappointing. Yeah. But I'm glad we talked about that. And like I said, at least my OCD will be satisfied about the mysterious death. So I can't be the only one who read that.
Probably
line.
Not.
So, all right. So we're going to move on to someone else profiled in the book, and which is, it's interesting in some ways. It's a lot of various people, various women in the book, exhibiting potential abilities of various degrees. But the one who stood out in the book as sort of the most, where I'm like, all right, I don't think this person is pulling off any kind of old-timey scams. Because, like, the Fox sisters, the whole thing with the Fox sisters, it's like, wait a minute. You know, this sounds like more of like a carnival show. Especially the toe cracking. I was like, how do you, I can't, is that possible? You can crack your toes? But Lenora Piper is who I'm talking about. The white girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, I found myself really, really taken with her because I was a straight up believer. The more you wrote about the things that she would demonstrate, it was like, okay, I don't see how this woman could be faking this. This is like documented events that are unfathomable.
Yeah, and she had some very smart people watching her like a hawk.
Right, like, exactly, yeah.
And the thing with SPR, their investigations wasn't just, oh, we'll go to one seance and write up. I mean, these investigations lasted for years sometimes. Like, wherever, like with Lenora Piper, wherever she went, it seemed like there was always an SPR member in the audience to document what was happening. So she put her – that's the other thing. She – voluntarily put herself through quite the amount of scrutiny and evaluation and examination. Back then, today, I mean, there would be some researchers getting sued, but back then when they were testing mediums, like when they would put when a medium would go into a trance, like they would burn them, they would cut them, like, you know, they would stab them with needles, like they did all these things to try to stimulate a reaction. So, and there is even some very questionable possible sexual assault that may have happened with these exams too, but
Jesus,
with how they were with those who excreted ectoplasm. I'll let you figure that out. Nice. What those examinations may have been like. But, yeah, so she put herself through a lot of scrutiny. And, I mean, there was a couple of people who were like, but, again, like I said, she had some very smart people that were evaluating her. And also, and William James was not someone who would go light on people either. Like, William James is pretty hardcore. But she was also somebody that seemed to be fairly honorable with her intentions. Like with some other mediums, like Florence Cook, who's going to be in volume two, her story was too much of a circus for me to put in volume one. I was like, okay, I need to make more sense of Florence Cook.
Yeah.
But it's alleged that Florence Cook may have had an affair with her SPR researcher that tainted his, crooks, that would have tainted his perspective of her and her his research. But with Lenora Piper, there wasn't any speculation of like that there may have been an affair happening. It seems like she was pretty honorable and quite legit. I mean, not saying having an affair is not honorable. I mean, get your kicks where you get your kicks, but you know, live your best life. But she seemed to be the one that was the most straightforward. Wasn't intimately involved with any of her researchers. And the researchers that were involved seemed to be, they didn't have a bias. They were very open-minded. She got tested by skeptics too, but there was one, I think it's Stanley Hall, I think is his name. He wasn't exactly nice to Lenora when testing her, but then, and that kind of like deflated her a little bit, which is a little sad, but she, you know, she just kept going, and she was able to provide some very invaluable data for, you know, researchers, which inadvertently affects how we research today. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was cool about, I guess, was interesting and kind of neat is she pops up again later in the book, and it's like I'm reading the book, and I'm already like, all right, this Lenora seems legit. Like I buy into Lenora. And then we get to the Dr. Florence Barrett chapter, and Dr. Florence Barrett is a superstar medical prominent figure in London, and gets into all of this. As I said, when I asked you, how'd you get mixed up in all this? She gets mixed up in all this when her husband dies. And a friend gets a letter from Lenora, who I'm just like, what? Wait, my Lenora? Like, I'm flipping back to them. I'm like, yeah, that's Lenora. And Lenora sends the letter, and she has a message from the late husband to a friend from, like, wicked far. Like, there's no way that – it's all so convoluted that it's like there's no way this could possibly be fake. Like, I'm sorry. Those are the kind of things that you read and you're like, all right, there's something to this. You can't really, I don't think Lenora spontaneously decided to write this person a letter with a message, like, and there's no way that the doctor facilitated this. So it's like, how do you explain it? It's just weird.
Yeah, it is. It's very weird. Florence Barrett. Yeah, she really was the superstar of women's health back then. You know, we try to ignore the eugenics part of it, but in her beliefs, but you know, there's not everyone's perfect. I mean, I got a couple of questionable women in these books. But yeah, Florence Barrett, I mean, she was married to one of SPR's founders, but she didn't really think anything of it, like you said, until after her husband died. And yeah, and the fact that you have a medical doctor, a well-established medical doctor who has wings named after her in hospitals that are still standing today. She wrote a whole book about conversations with her husband after he died. Lenora Piper sneaks in there, and there's actually a weird, like, I keep meaning to make like a chart or a tree or a flow chart or something of how all these women are connected.
Because, I love that.
Like Eleanor Sidgwick tested Helena Blavatsky, and then Blavatsky, you know, mentored Annie Besant, you know, so it's like, and then Annie Besant did this, and it's like they're everyone oddly is connected.
Yeah, I think you mentioned one of the women in the book, like, put up the funds for the Zenzer cards to be made, something like that. So yeah, I noticed that connection that you mentioned in the book too. Yeah, I would love that. That would be a really cool flowchart of like influences and connections.
I mean, like Thelma Moss, who was a Broadway actress before she got into parapsychology, you know, she tested Lorraine Warren. So it's like everyone has some kind of weird connection there in some sort of way. Gladys Osborne Leonard pops up a lot throughout the book because, you know, she was a very prominent medium at the time. So she was getting tested a lot. But yeah, it's just really cool to see how everyone kind of runs into each other and syncs with each other in a way, or inspires each other.
Yeah, yeah. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm not like a huge paranormal history buff. I guess you could say beyond like I know UFO history and cryptozoology. Yeah. I never kind of really got dug too deeply into paranormal history. So I was like blown away by just talking about sort of connections and recurrences and that kind of thing. SPR, Like, they, I feel like if anyone from, like, Netflix or something is watching, like, how about a Netflix series, like a Mad Men version of SPR? Because there's, like, there's so many connections and so many characters and so many, it's like, this is like a soap opera in and of itself, this SPR organization. I would love a show like that. It would be awesome.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. No, especially when one of the founders had an affair with another founder's brother. Like, it's spicy.
Very spicy. It's like spicy. Soap opera. Yeah.
It really is. Yeah. It really is. So, that'd be a good show, actually. All right.
Yeah, cool.
How do I pitch something to Netflix? Anyway.
Yeah. I need some kind of credit on that if it happens. Netflix, get in touch with us. We'll make this show happen. Yeah, yeah. Well, like you just mentioned before about someone having affairs with, like, their people who were studying them or whatever. It's like, wow, this must be – there's a book there just on this SPR group. I don't know if anyone's written that, but it was like, yeah, they keep recurring throughout your book, and it's like, this is quite the organization. That's kind of my eyebrows as I was going along. Now, credit to you, in the book is also a skeptic, Rose Mackenberg, who I loved. I found her adorable. Like, I just really liked her a lot. Just awesome. Just kind of like, talk about fit for a TV show. There's another one that you could do right there, Rose Mackenberg. Tell people about Rose Mackenberg, skeptic extraordinaire.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I love Rose Mackenberg, also known as Mac. So she was, I guess you could say, a protege of Harry Houdini. Harry Houdini was more than a magician. He was also out there debunking psychics, especially during the spiritualism movement. He got to a point where he was actually sending out, like, a small army of secret agents to cities. Like, if a psychic was going on tour or a medium was going on tour, he would send or if he was going on tour and going to town, he would send a small army of skeptics, secret agents, to go and check out the local mediums and then come back and report. And Rose Mackenberg, she had already exhibited some skeptical, like, beliefs, and it actually caught the attention of Harry Houdini. And she was such a rock star that she became his right-hand person.
Yeah.
Like, she would wear disguises.
That's what I love about it. Yeah, yeah. There's a picture in the book of her, like, all these different disguises. I'm like, what is it? I love this lady.
Right. And, like, the names, like, she would do, like, Francis Roud, so it'd be Froud or Fraud. Alicia Bunk, all is a bunk. I'm like, oh my gosh, she was brilliant. But yeah, she would be like a school teacher. She had a matron costume, servant girl. She had all of these personas so that people, you know, these mediums wouldn't recognize her.
Right.
And I was just like, this is so awesome. And I mean, she did put herself out there and was at risk at times, because she did get assaulted a couple times propositioned by some very questionable mediums. But, and then Harry Houdini would call them out next time he was on tour, and sometimes, like, whole riots would start. But, she was neat. She was really cool. Yeah. And she was somebody who, she was a skeptic, but she was always open and hopeful that something weird really would happen.
Right.
I found it interesting that she always kept her apartment well lit towards the end of her life because she was tired of dark rooms. but yeah, it's believed that she investigated about 1,000 mediums. She was one of the people that Houdini left a secret code for. Those of you who don't know, Harry Houdini had this agreement with his wife and several close friends that, you know, there would be a secret code that he would communicate in the afterlife.
Yeah.
And Rose was one of those people who got a code. And then she declared, like, that message didn't come through. She never did report on it. But yeah, she was really awesome. And then she kind of got thrown into the forefront as, like, I think she was called, like, the spook spy and Ghostbuster, like, before Ghostbusters was a thing. She was called a Ghostbuster.
Just really cool.
She was neat.
And it's interesting, in a way. Like, look, I don't know the history. I mean, I don't know the skeptic community very well at all, aside from sort of the very basics, but it's like, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Maybe you would know. Has she been marginalized in the skeptic community, I wonder? Like, I wonder if it's just the marginalization happens in all these fields, even in the skeptical community. I don't know.
It, you know, it has happened. I've met skeptics who didn't know who Rose was. They knew who Houdini was and his wife,
yeah.
But they didn't know Rose. She is becoming more known now, which is great. Unfortunately, there's even like believers who marginalize her. I attended a Victorian spiritualism panel at a big convention last year, and there was a panel on spiritualism. And I was like, okay, I want to go
yeah.
sit in on that. And they were trying to position the skeptics in the spiritualism movement as being anti-female and going against women because it was all
yeah.
men debunking these women. And I just quietly raised my hand. I'm like, and they're like, oh yeah. And I said, actually, I'm like, well, actually, but I'm like, look into Rose Mackenberg. She was Houdini's right-hand woman. She was very active in debunking mediums in the spiritualism movement.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Maybe not saying that it wasn't an attack on women, like for skeptics to attack the mediums, but it wasn't all men. There were women involved too. And it's important to acknowledge the women who were on the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of got a couple of dirty looks from the panelists that had said that claim initially, and I'm like, sorry. But it's important to, one, we don't want to spread that I don't want to call it misinformation because it almost sounds intentional, but we don't want to – misconception. We don't want to spread that misconception and also inadvertently ignoring a very important woman
right.
in the skepticism field.
Right, exactly. And I think even though we're kind of team paranormal, it's like, you gotta like respect, man. It's like, you gotta tip your cap. She's
yep.
awesome. So, and if you're busting fraudulent mediums and shit, I mean, team paranormal should be for that. Cause it's, we're trying to get to
you
the bottom
think.
Of this. Yeah.
You would think.
Right?
You would think.
Well, I thought it was interesting. You make a point, sort of trace this almost more the earlier women, but it kind of is an overarching theme in a lot of ways, is that the paranormal provided an outlet for them that there weren't a lot of opportunities. There really just
mm-hmm.
weren't a lot of opportunities for women, especially back in the times of Catherine Catherine Crowe. And they use these opportunities to advance women's rights and women's issues. I think it's really admirable, and it's instructive, where it's like, okay, this is how these – again, it's like I learned so much from the book, where it's like, all right, there weren't that many opportunities. So they found niches in the worlds of spiritualism and stuff like that, and then used those opportunities to advance women's rights and you know, voting rights and all the – you know, I think people, I guarantee people, young people who are listening who don't understand what it was like to back in the 1850s, it was a whole different world. So,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that's an interesting sort of aspect of the book that I wanted to note.
Yeah, no, I mean, spiritualism movement gave some incredible opportunities for women to be more independent.
Right.
I mean, spiritualism movements. I mean, there were some predatory behaviors happening. Like a lot of older men would marry like the teenage mediums so that they could be emancipated from their parents.
Oh, God.
And possibly for other reasons. But you know, spiritualists were very much involved in the abolition movement,
right.
suffragist movement.
I
did find a woman of color who was part of the spiritualism movement, and she's going to be in volume two.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so she was a delightful discovery. Anytime I found someone, I was like, oh, that's nice to meet you. You know, it's like, okay,
yeah.
I'm going to go look. For volume one, it was kind of like Helen Peters Nosworthy, but also Radcliffe Hall and Una Trowbridge, the lesbian power couple of the paranormal. I like to call them that. But yeah, so there was opportunities with the spiritualism movement for women to, ironically, you know, the only way they, I guess they could get people to listen to them was to channel like the spirit of a man and take on a male voice and communicate, and then they would be listened to. I did find that a little ironic.
You make that point in the book. Like I said, it didn't really dawn on me, but it's like, you're like, oh, well, let's talk to her because she's talking to Brian in the afterlife. It's like, oh, wait a minute, you're really, that was, So it, like I said, a takeaway from the book that resonated with me in a big way. Sort of moving into the modern people, I thought I was really interested. I had never heard of Akio Gibo.
Aiko Gibo,
Aiko Gibo, and I was blown away again. Another person like Lenora, where I was like, okay, I think this is like on the level here. This is pretty remarkable stuff. What she's doing here.
Yeah, so she's another one whose legacy does keep getting buried, and it's very frustrating, especially with the Mary King's Close and the Spirit of Annie. I was part of a documentary about scariest places in the world, and they did talk about Mary King's Close. And during my interview, I said Aiko Gibo's name at least a half dozen times. I was like, Aiko Gibo, you know, was visiting, and she felt this, and Aiko Gibo went to the store to get this Barbie doll, and Aiko Gibo went back down and gave the doll to Annie, and made it. Aiko Gibo is the reason why all these people bring the dolls to Annie, and. And then sure enough, they used somebody else's interview for that spot. And they said, oh, a medium detected the spirit of Annie. And I was like, no.
That's ridiculous. Yeah.
It was ridiculous. And I'm like, but they showed her picture. But they did show her picture. But I'm like, okay, you show her picture, but you don't say her name. Like,
That's pretty
ridiculous. And you know this in the book, the biggest takeaway that I want people to walk away with is please say their names. Like, say their names and talk about them. So I was while I was grateful for the opportunity, I was very frustrated when I saw that. Her legacy is one that still keeps getting buried. And I'm like, why is it so difficult to give her credit? And plus, she also very well could have been a part of like the early ghost hunting show format, because Japan in the 80s early 90s, you know, they would have, ironically, like during their daytime TV, they would have segments on like ghosts.
Yeah.
And Aiko Gibo was at the forefront of that. And you can actually watch her episodes on YouTube. I mean, they're in Japanese, but you can watch them and kind of get an idea of what's happening. And if you look at the way that it's shot, it's like very, it's reminds me a lot of like Ghost Adventures, early Ghost Hunters. And I'm just like, well, this is interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it was almost like what they did with Power Rangers and using like the B-roll B-roll for the battles and such. And I was like, this is interesting. I wonder where these producers got this idea to use this certain format, because the camera angles and everything.
I'm like,
this is oddly familiar. So, and she may have had a hand in that. I mean, I know producers are a thing too, but I mean, given how popular she was in Japan, I have family in Japan, and I also have friends in Japan. So I just reached out to them. I'm like, hey, do you know who Aiko Gibo is? And they're like, oh yeah, we do.
Well, that it raises a interesting sort of, I guess, challenge in a way. I mean, for lack of a better term, but it's like in reading the book, it's like I can only imagine because you, aside from Aiko Gibo, who's Japanese, you mostly cover British and American women, and I can only imagine. I mean, we don't even really know much about sort of the history of the paranormal in a lot of these other countries, period. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I'm sure there were so many other pioneering women that played roles in their respective countries and regions that you know, we may never know about. Just like, think about like that. Like Russia has a rich, deep history of this kind of the occult and the paranormal. And it's like, there must be multiple women just there, Latin America, you know, other parts of Europe, France, Germany, that kind of thing. So it's like there's no shortage, really, I bet.
Yeah, well, you might be interested in volume two because I do dive into China a little bit with volume
Oh,
two.
there's
Not
another one.
necessarily,
Yeah.
yeah. So, but you do bring up something interesting, and really, what I'm going off of is like what's documented and what
Exactly,
exists
yeah.
in historical records, and it makes it hard because the documenting of with other countries is sometimes not consistent, but it's also like, does the Library of Congress have it? Does the local library have this data? And what could
Yeah.
I find on Internet Archive and searching? And I found Iko Gibo a little bit by accident, because I was actually doing research on Mary King's Close. I had never been there, but I was made aware of like of a parapsychology experiment that at Edinburgh Castle and Mary King's Close, and I was like, well, where'd the story of Annie come from? So I did some more research on Annie, and then Iko Gibo's name came up on an Instagram post of all things. And I was like, oh, why don't we know about her? So I've
Yeah,
been trying to
exactly.
do
Yeah.
a little bit more deeper dive into international side of it.
That's awesome.
But it makes it tough because the documentation is tough. But yeah, it's a because right now you're right. It's a lot of American and British women.
Yeah.
I do have one Canadian coming up, and then and I like I said, I found the woman of color who was a spiritualist because I'm really still
Right,
trying to
right.
drive diversity with it. But a lot of times I'm looking into like. There was an ancient Chinese woman that I found who wasn't necessarily like an occultist, but she, but maybe more of a spiritualist. But it's
Yeah.
also like, well, what was her impact? What did she influence? And that's the other thing I have to look at is,
Right, right.
did she create a tradition or did she create a methodology? Because there's so many women out there that could be included, but it's like, okay, what was their contribution? Not saying that what they did
Right, right.
wasn't good or good enough, but it's like. Is it like Catherine Crow or is it,
Yeah,
is
yeah,
it
yeah.
something that has rippled out into something that's
Exactly, yes.
leveraged in the future? Because otherwise, I mean, I could probably write this series for the rest of my life.
Yeah, no, exactly, yeah. Now you mentioned a couple in the book that I actually didn't have in the notes, but I think I had kind of been like, all right, well, I don't know if I'm gonna, I had to cut some, but we're doing pretty good on time. So let's talk about Radcliffe Hall and Una Trowbridge. As you mentioned, you called them the lesbian power couple. They just remarkable folks.
Yeah. Radcliffe also went by the
John.
name John.
Right,
Yeah,
right.
that was a tricky chapter for me to write because, pronouns matter and they are a
Exactly,
thing.
yeah. It was a very, yeah,
And
no, it was very, well, yeah, it was interesting. It was interesting.
yeah, Radcliffe had a very interesting journey. She, and I'm using she because that's the pronouns that she used. If Radcliffe was alive today in our modern times, that may have been a little different. But Radcliffe came into, I mean, was in money, like very wealthy, thanks to family. And Radcliffe was like, you know what? I don't have to get married to a man to survive. I'm gonna dress up in men's clothing and I'm gonna live my true self and live my life.
There you go.
I mean, Radcliffe Hall wrote probably one of the most prominent pieces of queer literature, The Well of Loneliness. There is some speculation that Una and Radcliffe may have been fascists, but again, we have Frances or we have Florence Barrett with her eugenics, so it's like, yeah,
Yeah.
But it was also early 1900s, 1930s, 1940s. It's like,
Yeah.
eh.
It was of the time. But what's interesting about Radcliffe is it was of the time, it was, I imagine it was like, I mean, that takes a certain amount of guts to live your life the way you want to live your life during that time. That was what blew me away about her.
That's the thing. Yeah, and Una too. They when I tell people about Una Trowbridge and Radcliffe Hall, they were not in the closet. Like you
Right,
can look at
exactly.
pic you see pictures of them, and it's like, oh, right away.
Right,
Like
right.
it's and ironically, how they got into spiritualism and parapsychology was because Radcliffe had been in a relationship with Una's cousin for a significant amount of time, and her name nickname was Lady. And then towards the end of Lady's life, Radcliffe meets Una and Radcliffe kind of start this affair while Lady is on her deathbed. Lady passes away, and then there's like this guilt of maybe we should have held off on starting this relationship until after she passed, you know, that kind of guilt.
Right,
and
right.
Then Radcliffe got a letter from someone saying, hey, you need to check out this medium who was Gladys Osborne Leonard. Radcliffe goes, does a sitting with Gladys, and Gladys seems to know things about Radcliffe that no one else would know. And it's indicative that it's possibly Lady coming through. And so Radcliffe's like, okay, I'm going to come back, brings Una Trowbridge with her next time. They always have someone recording whenever, like, they're doing a sitting with Gladys Osborne Leonard. And, yeah, it just kind of turned into this thing where they did the investigation, they did the write-ups. They were really good at documenting what they were working on too. They did some pretty great work with that. And then and ironically, they were encouraged by a very prominent member of SPR. Oh my gosh, and again, I'm forgetting his name. It's all these people at SPR.
That SPR, been in SPR again.
Yeah, it's again SPR. So they end up submitting their investigation of Gladys Osborne Leonard to the Proceedings of the Society for Psychical Research. And yeah, and then they become council members. So
yeah,
they were very much in it.
Right,
they were in it to win it. And
yeah. And trailblazers.
They were. They really were. And again, you know, you look at them, they were not in the closet. And SPR was you're welcome here. So SPR kind of became this safe haven for queer people during, you know, 19th, 20th century England, which is incredible, which is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so I'm going to wrap you up with a couple of super contemporary names, two women, wonderful women, who actually were on Banal of America in the past and who we lost in the last few years, mm-hmm. and who I was thrilled to see were included in the book, starting with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, who I was in awe of her when I had her on Banal of America. I think it was kind of like one of those, like, I don't even know. She is such a titan, and she's so she has such a wide array of expertise that I'm like, I don't even know where to begin with this interview. Like, I haven't gone back and listened to it in a long time, but I've actually cited parts of our conversation in future interviews because stuff had come up in that interview that stayed with me. In the episode a couple weeks ago with Josh Cutchin, I mentioned that conversation with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. She was tremendous. The sheer amount of material that she produced is staggering. It really, really is. Talk a little bit about Rosemary Ellen Guiley, because you include her in the book here too, you know, rightfully so. I'm glad she's in the first volume, in a way. It's like the first Hall of Fame class or something like that. It's kind of like well-earned and well-deserved.
Yeah, she was incredible. I had the pleasure of meeting her like a couple of years before she passed. I regret I never got a photo with her, though, and I didn't talk to her more because I was also like intimidated and very much in awe. I'm like, that's Rosemary Ellen Guiley. You know, it's one of those things. She was amazing. And so she was actually somebody, also her legacy was a catalyst for writing the book too, because I have a little bit of a presence on TikTok, and I mentioned Rosemary Ellen Guiley during a TikTok live, and a younger investigator was like, who? And I'm like, okay, let's talk, you know? I mean, she wrote so many books too, and I'm just like, man, she's inspirational. So her legacy was something I really wanted to make sure was at least in print. And so I got help from several people to write her chapter. Lisa Crick was one, someone she mentored, John Zaffis, helped out quite a bit, and then another guy named Kevin, who worked with her quite a bit. And then her husband actually chatted with me too.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so he chatted with me for quite a bit to talk about her legacy, you know, as you know, as like as someone from the outside, you know, what was all this like for you? And
Yeah,
so Joe was a great guy. I ended up sending him a copy of the book too. It's like, hey, you know, here's
Great.
Yeah. So I really wanted to make sure like she was in the book and her legacy was definitely in print somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, she was a powerhouse, and that's a tremendous loss to the field too.
Oh, absolutely.
Huge loss. So
Yeah, I think most of the listeners know, like I said, she was on the show before, so it's kind of like the BOA listeners, they're old heads. So they know Rosemary Ellen Galley, and just tremendous. An incredible legacy. And I hope that, you know, she's so recent that people won't forget her. But I think also, in a way, it's definitely the women have been marginalized, but there's something, I don't know, with our contemporary culture where it's like, I just think that the history of all this in general is kind of like getting lost as we go along, which is weird because you would think that there, with all the information available online, there would be a better understanding of history. But it seems like, you know, even like a Brad Steiger. I'm sure if you mentioned Brad Steiger on your TikTok, there'd be plenty of people who are like, who are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so it's just kind of a bummer, especially I've been around forever. And so I had a lot of these people on the show, you know,
yep.
It's like Brad Steiger, you know, Stan Friedman, ring a bell, Jim Mars, you hear these mm-hmm. people. It's like, and there are people out there who are like, no, I don't know who any of them are. It's like, what? Like, what? How do you not know who these people are? Another super cool lady in the book, Linda Godfrey. You had the same kind of, there was just something about Linda Godfrey. She's just such a sweet lady. And I think that in a sense, there's almost like a vindication in a way. If we talk about the women we've talked about earlier in the book, we talk about earlier in the conversation, we talk about, you know, Pamela Coleman Smith never gets any credit for the tarot card. Helen Noseworthy never gets any credit for naming the Ouija board. Catherine Crowe, no credit really for bringing in poltergeist and doppelganger. At least there's some kind of like karmic vindication in a way as you wrap up the book. Linda Godfrey, she is the Beast of Bray Road. Like, we know she will forever be the one who put Beast of Bray Road on the map. And the story mm-hmm. itself is, as you tell it, like in the book, it's just so amazed. Like she's kind of like, there's no shenanigans. She just like stumbled into this thing that became a phenomenon mm-hmm. and became a pillar of, you know, a fixture in the cryptozoological community. So, I love Linda Godfrey. She was so sweet. I had the chance to meet her a few years back at one of Lauren Coleman's conferences up in Portland, and just the nicest lady, and just a wonderful, wonderful lady.
Yeah. She was one that I regrettably never had a chance to meet, but I did talk to Jay. I always butcher his last name, Bachichin. I talked to Jay, and Jay and her worked – I mean, they lived not too far from each other as well. So, and they were very close friends. Like, she kind of took on a grandmother role with his kids, and hearing her legacy through his perspective was really, truly an honor. It was really an honor to cover that. And with the more modern ones, I really wanted to make sure, like, hey, at least I'm talking to family members or friends or mentees, colleagues, just to kind of get a picture of what their legacy was like. And everybody, for the most part, with all of the women, with all of the more modern women in the book, were very kind and very generous with their time. So, because really, it's like I could tell Linda's story, but I didn't know Linda personally. So that's why I leaned on Jay. It's like, hey, tell me about Linda. Like, tell me about what she meant to you. Tell me about what her legacy is and what people should do to honor her memory.
Exactly. Yeah. And Rosemary and Linda are sort of special cases in the sense where it's like they just passed away a few years ago. So it's like.
Yeah.
Too
far apart from each other either.
That's
a huge hit. Again, it was a huge hit to the community, especially for women in the community.
Absolutely.
It's like,
yeah.
That's a hit.
So I think it's important. We should talk about the last parts. Like, what can we do? What can we do to, you know, keep the spirit of these women alive and educate people about their contributions? I like to think that we've done a good job here tonight and sort of for the banal. All this stuff I learned, I've now tried to impart it back out to the listeners here tonight in the sense and in wanting them to educate about the stuff. But they have to go get the book because we only scratched the surface. There's 38 women profiled in the book and I just cherry picked them. So there's tons of other fantastic women in there. But what else do you suggest that people do? It's kind of weird in a way. It's like my past life school teacher thing. It's like some of these women I kind of wanted to know more about. Pick a woman and maybe learn more about them if you read Alex's book. I mean, that's what I would suggest because that's kind of how I came out of it, where I'm like, I'd really like to know more about Anna Goodrich Freer. Like, let me see what's going on with that. But you're the author, so and this is an important part of the book. So what do you think?
Yeah, I always recommend to people that if you want, say their names. And also, if you want to learn more, I have a small bibliography after each woman. So if you want to follow up on my sources, you can definitely do that. Like, there's some women like Alexandra David Neal who have like multiple books written about them. Right. She was a trip too. tells her husband she's going to be gone for like 6 months to go to India, and then she's gone for 14 years.
She was a character. Yeah.
A character. But, yeah, so talk about them, but also to kind of continue the spirit of these women, especially with Rosemary.
Absolutely, yeah.
One of the heartbreaking things with Rosemary was she had fought so hard to break the glass ceiling and to get more inclusion for women in paranormal media. And right when she got her big break was when she got sick. It's heartbreaking because she had worked so hard. So something that I do encourage people to do is – if you're willing to be an advocate, especially with like paranormal media, paranormal events, let these networks know that you want to see more women.
Yeah.
Let them know that, or event planners, like if there's an event that you see that has a very male heavy lineup, suggest some women like, hey, I would love to see Amanda Woomer at your event. Yeah, that too. they've been taking me. I got 16 events this year, so I haven't done. I'm at capacity now. So it's like suggest women to be at these events. Buy their books. That's a big thing. Buy their books. Consume their content. You know, when you go on YouTube looking for paranormal content to watch, Paranormal Twins, you tune in to Travel the Dead with Katrina Weidman and Heather Taddy. Let those numbers and the algorithm know that women in the paranormal are valuable and should get more exposure. So start supporting women in the field is a big thing I want people to do as well. Like, because the women women of the paranormal, their legacies were buried. And let's try to change that now so that there doesn't have to be like more volumes of women in the paranormal in the future, because we've already done a great job of elevating women in the field.
That's a great way of putting it. Absolutely. Now, you mentioned you got a whole bunch of dates. I was blown away. I saw it on your Facebook page. I was like, oh my God, this is like, I don't know how you do it.
I know. Last year I did a similar and it burned me out. I was just, man, once December hit, I just wanted to sleep. Just put me in hibernation. So this year I am doing a little more bit on the local side, so it's not as much traveling. Some of those dates may have to drop off because either work, because like I said, I travel a lot for work and some things have changed where I'm like, oh, wait, I have to go to London. Oops. So some of those dates are probably going to drop off. And I may pull back a little bit just because last year was so exhausting. But what I will be at Haunted America, that's run by Troy Taylor. That's a fantastic event. Con Carolinas, because I'm also the paranormal track director, like I kind of have to be there.
And you're doing your own event, right?
Yep. Trivia Clinic Parafest, I'm co-coordinating, and then of course the Paranormal Research Symposium. Yeah, that's kind of the plan there. And then of course I have all these other paracons in between, like White Hill Mansion Paracon, Ghostwriters Weekend, Mass Paracon. Plus I am doing a couple investigations too, because last year I didn't really do a lot of investigating because of all the events. So so I got a busy 2024 coming up. Schedule may change. We'll see.
All right. Yeah. And people can find out at alexmatsuo.com. Now, what's next for you with how about volume two? Because I loved volume one. Now I want to get volume two. Like, you know, when I'm going to be one of those fans who's like, when's it going to be out? So what's the plan on volume two?
So the ideal plan with volume two is to have it out by Haunted America. So that would be June.
Okay.
It's a little over 60% done. It's just one, I have to wrap up a book that I'm contracted with through a publisher. So I'm hoping to get that done within the next week. And then last year, Women of the Paranormal volume one went into editing in May and it was out by mid June. So,
okay.
I was working around the clock to make that happen, but, you know. So ideally, I would like to have Women of the Paranormal Volume 2 out in June. If not June, then because I have a release coming out in the fall, I may push it to either Women's History Month next year for March, but that's a little bit of a long time. But we'll see what happens. After I get – I'm never working on two books at the same time ever again. This was a learning experience for me because I kind of got the anxiety, ADHD, freeze, procrastination thing really bad. It's like, oh, which book am I going to work on? I don't know. Which book are you going to work on? Is it going to be
– Neither of them.
Neither. That's what it turned into. It was like Virginia, women. Virginia or women. Crap, I did neither and it's midnight now. But now it's like, okay, the deadline for Haunted Northern Virginia is April 8th. I need to get my butt here. Yeah. Well, I have 15,000 words left for that one. But that one's like, oh, this house was built in 1825 and it's haunted by an old man.
Yeah, you know, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
It's a little fluffier. So it's, it's fluffier.
Now, have you, the volume one is primarily, sort of the ghost realm and, psychic type of stuff. I'm terrible with the vernacular, but have you considered any, I'm sure you have considered it, but is there a possibility of seeing some women maybe from some of the other sort of other fields of the paranormal? I'm thinking like a Coral Lorenzen of Apro or Mae Brussel, who was like a big time conspiracy figure in the 80s or so, in the zine era. Just those are a couple of people like off the top of my head that I was like, that would be interesting. It would be cool if they were included at some point in this compendium. I don't know about the conspiracy part, but certainly Coral Lorenzen, and the name escapes me, Tohunga Canyon, Andruppel, who's another pioneering UFO researcher. So I don't know. I'll throw those out there.
maybe
a future thing.
So I know there is another author working on like women in the UFO community.
Oh, okay.
So I was actually going to reach out to her and be like, hey, I'm kind of working on something similar and I wanted to include a couple UFO women. Kind of professional courtesy of like, hey,
absolutely.
But yeah, so I do have a few more new age women as well, especially with astrology. Like, I just happened to find some really interesting, like, women with astrology. Created, like, the astrology charts. Oh, what's her name? Can't remember. Which is why we need the book.
Those
little astrology scrolls that you get at the grocery store, like, she's the one behind that. And ironically, a lot of the mediums, like, this time around, the spiritualist mediums were kind of proven to be frauds, but the way that they went about it was so comical and really made like SPR and Ghost Club really have to step up their game with like how they debunked and how they researched. And I'm like, I got to put them in. Like Usapia Paladino, it kind of turned into this like almost wacky racist type of thing with her, because she'd get debunked, but then she'd just keep going to another country and keep doing her thing. And it was like this wacky racist thing where it's like, they're all or like the Scooby-Doo chase, like through all the doors.
Right,
like,
she, yeah, yeah.
Like, it's just, I'm howling with laughter reading about her. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, she's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I also have a lot more occultists this time around. Like, I didn't really expect that, but like Moynia Mathers, she's going to be in there. Sybil Leek, Helen Duncan, they're in there for at least I'm pretty sure for volume two. I do have a couple more modern ones, maybe a little bit more than last time, including my mentor. She passed away last year, and I'm like, yeah, I got to include her because she's kind of the reason, like one of the big reasons why I wanted to write the book, because I'm like, well, you know, and she did a lot for cryptozoology in Canada. So I'm it's legit.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you that about cryptozoology, because that's definitely a field where you don't hear of any prominent women, almost exclusively. There's some contemporary women who are, you know, making a mark in the field. And of course, we talked about Linda, but when you sort of hear about the old timey, I think there was like four dudes. I don't know. They had a nickname or something, like the Four Horsemen of Bigfootery or some shit.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like four guys that were like the Bigfoot people. But I also just dawned on me too, Sherry Steiger was pretty, Brad and Sherry were, you know, they were kind of a team. So it's like, but Brad always, you know, people always remember Brad Steiger, but if Brad were here right now, I'm sure he'd be insisting. He'd be like, that was all Sherry, man. That was, so.
Yeah.
Another person of great import.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I also have Claudia Ackley too. She is an interesting one. She sued the state of California for not willing to research Bigfoot. I thought that was interesting.
Oh,
I'm like,
oh wow.
I think her name, I want to say her name was Claudia Ackley. Now, whether or not she really saw Bigfoot or not is whether that was a thing or not.
Did she pass away more recently?
She did. She passed away in 2023.
I thought I remember hearing that.
Yeah, she passed very recently. Who else am I going to include? Oh, yeah. So I'm kind of going over, like, there's going to be some more modern women this time around. And we'll see what happens.
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. As you can tell, I'm really looking forward to it. So we talked about alexmatsuo.com. That's where people can find where you're going to be speaking. You got a book on Northern Virginia, I think you said, Haunted Stuff. That's coming out later this year, probably. Volume two, you hope to get it out. Anything else you want to plug here? You got a YouTube channel. You may have a podcast. I don't know. You're very prolific. I'm very impressed with your hustle in the world of the paranormal. So I'm incredibly lazy. So
I'm very tired. I am very tired. I mean, my website's the best place to go. Like I said, I'm wrapping up a book about haunted Northern Virginia that will be out in hopefully September. And then Women of the Paranormal Volume 2, probably, hopefully, June for Haunted America. And, I'm actually going to be diving into a non-paranormal book project with some history writing. And then there's a couple of haunted locations that I frequent that want me to write a book about their place. So I'm like, all right, there might be some.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something there. All right.
Something there, yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, Alex, I can't thank you enough. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. As you know, when I was emailing you yesterday, I was like, I cannot wait to talk about this book. I really enjoyed it quite a bit. And as I said, I learned so much. And that's really, I think the listeners could tell, like when I start out the show and I'm just ranting and raving and ready to go, they're like, oh, shit, Benal's got something he wants to tell us here that he picked up from tonight's guest. Like how I could barely contain myself with Justin McHenry and the Lemuria book. That's how I felt tonight going into this conversation, because I'm like, I cannot wait to talk about all this amazing stuff that Alex has has put in this book. It's really, really awesome. And I can't put it over enough, folks. Go out and get it. It's on Amazon right now. And you can find out more from Alex at alexmatsuo.com. And that's it. I have a feeling you're going to be back on Banal of America. I hope if you'll come back. I would love to have you back on the show, on multiple occasions. I really enjoy talking to you, and you bring a real thoughtfulness to this field that is appreciated on this end of the screen here in this weird call. So
thank you so much. Thanks for having me.